do my hair toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling? Hair toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling?
Hey, you guys, this is Sarah Troutman, and welcome to Reveal, the podcast where we talk about incredible stories of amazing women and how they've used the best of behavioral science to find a pathway forward. And today, I'm so excited to talk to my new friend, Danielle Beal. She has been a behavior analyst and in this field for over 20 years, and her story is one that you really want to tune into. So I like what I see when I'm looking at me when I'm walking past the mirror. Don't stress through the night at a time and my life ain't worried about if you feel it. Got my head on straight, I got my vibe right, I ain't gonna let you kill it. See, I won't change my life just by. Good morning, Danielle.
Good morning, Sarah. I'm so happy to talk with you.
I'm so happy to talk to you too. Okay, so you and I are new friends, which is very exciting to me. I love making new friends. And the way that we got connected is you reached out to me, I think was it on Instagram? And you were just like, hey, I think that we should, you know, have a conversation. I think we should get to know each other better. And I responded with, yeah, let's do that. And so we've been able to have all of these like really awesome and amazing interactions over the last, what, like month or so?
Yeah, I'd say. Yeah, actually, I saw a story on Instagram and said, I'm finally going to reach out. And I emailed you and just said, hey, let's get to know each other. And I'm really happy I did.
Me too. And we obviously have had a chance to talk about, you know, your story and your background prior to recording this podcast. And I remember last week when we were speaking, you know, with every kind of like subsequent, you know, piece that you would share of your story, I was like, no way, that didn't happen. I can't believe this because it's just, it's so incredible. Yeah. So from my perspective, the best place to start is at the beginning. Because you entered this world in dramatic fashion.
Yes.
So can you kind of talk to people about how you came to be born and the circumstances around your birth?
Yeah. And before I kind of jump into that, I want to say that I have kind of been told my story, you know, in bits and pieces throughout my life. And so I always had an awareness of it. And then last year I was asked to do an assignment for school where I had to create a genogram. And a genogram is kind of this history of family stuff, and I put it together and I never seen it in completion in its entirety, and it kind of blew me away. But as I was looking for details about my mom and my dad, and I was kind of Googling stuff, I actually found newspaper clippings of my mom's, you know, story and my story. And it was pretty surreal to hear, you know, something your whole life and then to actually like be able to Google it and find bits and pieces of it. It wasn't accurate according to the story that I've been told, but surreal, you know, to say the least. Yeah. So basically, my mom was 19. She was a runaway. And she moved down here to Pomona and met my dad, who I guess wasn't the best guy. And he used to physically abuse her. And during one altercation, she was about 7-8 months pregnant with me. And she actually ended up stabbing him in self-defense and went to jail. And that's where I was born, as she was awaiting trial. She eventually got off on self-defense, but that's where I was born. She went to the hospital, had me, went back, and eventually got off on self-defense.
Was she able to bring you back with her to prison, or did she have to leave you with a family member while she went back to prison after you were born?
Yeah, so she went back to prison, and I stayed with one of her best friends, who, as I understand it, was young, a few years older than she was at the time, and the girl's mother. And actually, she had tried to take the rap for my mom. And so, in all of the newspaper articles that I had found, my mom's name is intertwined with her friend's name. there's some confusion there, but I stayed with them until my mom got out and was able to regain custody of me.
Yeah. And your mom was very purposeful with how she named you. And so I think this is something that's going to be really important, because what I think that people are going to see when they see marketing materials is like, excuse me, you, why did you make Danielle's the first letter of her first name and the first letters of her last name lowercase? You made it an error, but that's not an error.
It's not. And, you know, I haven't really been able to talk about this, any of this really, you know, publicly, at all in my life. I've, you know, told friends in confidence, and, you know, my husband knows all of my story. My daughter's, you know, my older daughter knows parts of it, but I haven't been comfortable talking about it. It was just something that was a part of my life. So as a little girl, my mom was very adamant about my name, and I never really understood why. My mom was very particular about the way that she did things and the way that we were. And she was just very particular. And so I used to get in trouble. I remember being at school, learning how to write my name and trying to write it the way that my mom had taught me, and the teachers, you know, really fussing at me and saying, nope, it's with a big D and there's no Y here. It's supposed to be an I. And my mom would go ballistic. She would come down to the school, and I just remember her like cussing everyone out and acting a fool. And it's been like that my whole life. And so that's how I wrote my name. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, when my husband and I got engaged, and actually before that, we had decided to move in together. I finally went through a box of my mom's stuff that I hadn't gone through after her death. And I found a journal that she had written during that time in her life. And she really wrote my name, Danielle Sherelle Goitia was my birth name. And I guess during the course of her time in jail, she was friends with some people in there, and she had really wanted to, I don't even know how to articulate it. She really wanted to make sure that I was given some chance. And so she was very deliberate in the way that my name was. And she wanted it to be Danielle Sherelle because it rhymed, because it was a different name. You know, she had never seen Danielle with a Y. She wanted it all lowercase. She had written her name in all lowercase. And she really wanted people to notice me. She wanted me to make a mark in the world. And she had written that down in this book. But can you imagine, like, my whole life being stuck and attached to this name, and really it being a big deal and me not really understanding why. And then as an adult, as I'm starting this new chapter in my life with my now husband, really this unfolding and really like me looking at it, like she was leaving a legacy for me. She was giving me something, you know, that would be long lasting, you know, after her death, and that would carry me really throughout my life.
Yeah. And I think something that's important for people to understand is your mother was white and your father was black. And there was some real, I think, challenges for your mom, because you're one of three children. And all of you guys are biracial. And I think it was really, I know that we've talked about this, was really challenging for your mother to kind of figure out how to honor that. And I think that was hard for her, which made, I think, and I don't want to put words into your mouth, and let me know if I'm like encapsulating what we've talked about correctly. It's like, how do you know how to love yourself and love your black skin if that has never been taught to you, you know? And that doesn't mean that your mother didn't love you. And I think sometimes people think issues of race, you know, pun intended, are black and white. And that's just not the case. Your mother loved you very deeply, but she didn't really understand what it meant to help empower her children to love themselves as black individuals. And how did that kind of affect your sense of self kind of growing up and how you have perceived who you are and your value?
So my mom was actually Mexican. So she was Hispanic and Spaniard. So her dad was from Spain. Her mom was from Mexico. So she was Hispanic. And she, like you mentioned, had three black babies, and all of us were born by men who, you know, weren't very worthy of her love or, you know, their children. And so my dad, you know, physically abused her. She met him when she was 16. My sister's father actually raped my mother. And so my sister was a product of rape, and my mom had a lot of anger, and a lot of issues came up as a result of her having my sister. And then my brother's father, who she actually married, abused us throughout our childhood. And as a result, you know, we were removed from the home and placed into foster care as children. And my whole life growing up, I heard that Black people were this and Black people were that, and that we should really embrace, you know, my mom's culture, the Hispanic culture. And it's not that my mom, you know, hated Black people. Obviously she had three Black babies, but she couldn't resolve how these men had treated her and how, you know, and the result of that abuse that she suffered. And, you know, I remember her having Black friends, and they would, you know, try to teach her how to comb our hair. And I remember, like, the first time she tried to, you know, put a relaxer in my hair to straighten my curls. And my sister had a very, she's actually darker skinned, and, you know, her hair is a lot different texture. It's a different texture than mine. And we just struggled. We struggled with our identity. Like, I struggled hating myself. I struggled being really confused. I felt like I looked in the mirror and I looked Black, and I felt Black. You know, was always pulled into this culture. I remember my stepdad's family and really being attached to people in that family. And it was really confusing. I went to school and, you know, I'd get made fun of, and, you know, I was too Black for, you know, some children, and too, you know, light for the Black children. And I never fit in. I was weird. And I you know, had speech issues growing up, and, we were neglected. And so it was a really challenging time. I never knew how to do my hair. It was always this big frizzy mess, and it was just a complicated time. And it wasn't until, I think, middle school, where a teacher saw me, and I remember the first time she told me I was beautiful because I was Black. And this was really a stepping stone for me to really start to find myself, find my voice, and really embrace my skin. Because up until that point, I just received a lot of mixed messages about beauty and worth, and, you know, just learning how to love myself.
Well, and you know, people maybe don't know this, so I'm outing our age right now. Okay. So are you ready for this? So you and I are the same age. And we were, you know, born in the late 70s. And when we were growing up, it was a different time. And it wasn't, there was no Black girl magic. No. You know, there was no, like, wear your natural hair. And, you know, we see value in that and beauty in that. It was like, here's the, you know, relaxers, and here's all the other things. And like, you're allowed to, you know, be Black in this very narrow space. And, you know, it's, I mean, cause both of us have Black daughters. And so it's been such a different, it's so interesting for me to see what my daughter's been able to have in her life. And she feels so confident about her Blackness, and she just revels in it. And she's like, you know, she just, it's everything to her. And I love that. And that's been, you know, something that's been important for me, that she have those messages of beauty, especially because my daughter's very dark skinned, you know, and it also, I mean, you know this, I mean, it's like the idea that, like, beauty, especially if you are a Black woman, is on the skin, you know, like, are you, like, light? Are you medium? And, like, the lighter you are, the prettier you are. And the and it's just like, no. And I told, I told my daughter this a long time ago. I was like, Tess, you know, the darker the berry, the sweeter the juice. She's like, She's like, Mom, I have very sweet. I'm like, I know, I know. And I think part of it, I have so much compassion for your mom, because also it's like, where would she have been getting these messages to know to say this to you? Because that wasn't, you know, what was going on in the 80s when we were coming up, and in the early 90s, you know, it's like, you know, you had, like, Living Color, and you had, like, Cosby Show, and, like, a couple things. But again, it was just like this, like, narrow space. Versus, you know, I think now, again, like, our, especially your younger daughter has, you know, this benefit of growing up in a totally different way. And something that I know that's also been really critical for you is, despite all of the really challenging circumstances with, you know, your stepfather and the abuse, and, you know, being in and out of different houses, you've had these, like, key women in your life that have really, really held you down. And can you talk, so you're saying, like, hey, I had that teacher when I was in junior high that was the first person to tell me that I was beautiful, but also there's a really another key figure from high school.
Yes.
Can you talk about her?
Yeah. So just going back a bit, you brought up a really good point. And I never had thought about this perspective. And I actually want to spend some time kind of thinking mm-hmm. through that, because as I've aged, I've had to learn how to forgive my mom and, yeah. You know, in her absence, and really understand her as a woman who suffered yeah. her own traumas, and really what that would be like to be raising, you know, three Black babies with no outline and no formula. And I remember, and it's so funny that you said this exactly, because we hadn't talked about this. I remember when In Living Color came out. And so I was always like, as soon as I like that teacher kind of approached me, I became like really like pro-Black, like I'm mm-hmm. gonna like shout it from the rooftops, like I'm Black and I'm proud. And that was me just, you know, being an attention seeking, you know, adolescent. But I remember coming home and my mom said, Danielle, there's this new show. It's called In Living Color. And I think you'll like it because there's Black people in it. And that was kind of looking back, and like the Cosby Show, she was always mm-hmm. trying to create space for me to kind of form an identity through, you know, television. Mm-hmm. Or my little sister is 100% Hispanic. Like if you saw her, mm-hmm. you wouldn't even like know that we were related. She has a thick accent. She mm-hmm. only speaks Spanish. She has, you know, Hispanic babies, like, mm-hmm. so she fully, you know, was, you know, which is a whole other issue. But my mom, that was my mom's kind of way of trying to carve out this space for me. It was mm-hmm. like, watch Living Color, and that's mm-hmm. how you're going to learn how to be, you know, a Black girl. And so you said that, and I wanted to share that. But yeah, so I met this teacher in junior high, and I started kind of getting interested in like Black History Month and learning more about Black history. And at this time, most of my friends were Black, and, you know, any, you know, boys that I was interested in were Black. And then through high school, I met a boy, and I met his mom, and immediately she just gravitated to me. She just was like, an amazing, amazing woman. And she, the first question she asked me was, so where are you going to college? And I was like 16 years old. And I was like, I'm not going to college. I'm going to, you know, I'm taking care of my sister and brother, and I have to take care of my mom, because, you know, she was really in and out of sickness in the hospital, and we were dealing with a lot of stuff. And I was like, college is not anything that, I'm planning on doing. And she's like, nope. Like, you're smart, you're bright. Like, you're not staying in Victorville. You're not taking, yeah. it's not your.
She's like, come on, want more for yourself. Cause yeah, I want more yeah. for you.
That's yeah. exactly. And that's really been the theme of our relationship. And, you know, so over the course of, you know, the next couple of years before I actually went to college, she was filling out college applications for me. On my 18th birthday, she bought me a luggage set. I mean, she took me to go get my driver's license because my mom wasn't doing any of those things, obviously. Mm-hmm. She was like, this is what you do to prepare to leave the house. And up until that point, Sarah, I had been a crutch for, you know, for my mom, Gloria, and really taking care of her and my siblings, and just making sure that we were fed and the house was clean. And I hadn't even thought beyond Victorville, mm-hmm. California at that point.
Yeah. And can you just say her name just so people know, cause we're going to talk about her later.
Yes. Okay. So her name is Theresa Shellcroft. Mm-hmm. But we call her Bisa affectionately, because when my older daughter was little, she could not say Miss Theresa. We have to mm-hmm. address all of our adults with respect, and we often mm-hmm. call them Miss or Mister. And so mm-hmm. she couldn't say Miss Theresa, so she called her Babisa. And so for 20-something years, we've affectionately called her Bisa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we will come back to Bisa, because yes. Bisa has a primary role in your life. Still,
yeah.
Yeah. Which I love. So, but Bisa's son, you guys broke up.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then when did you meet Trevor?
Okay. So this is one of my favorite stories to tell. And if my husband were here, he'd be like, oh God, here we go. But I love this story because this is how I began to grow and, overcome my childhood. So we all went to school together. Her son and I dated very briefly. It was, you know, we were young, we were 16. It was a very kind of innocent first love, you know, type relationship. And after we broke up, you know, Bisa, I remember like calling me and saying, I don't want this relationship to end. You mean a lot to me. My son means a lot to me. I don't know how to navigate this, but I would love to stay in your life. And I don't know, looking back, and actually I'm going to see her. I spend Mondays with her. Me and Skylar spend Mondays with her. I'm going to ask her today. Like, I wonder if a part of her wanting to stay in touch was making sure that I was okay. Mm-hmm. Like, that I didn't stay in Victorville, that I didn't get sucked back into. Because if she wouldn't have reached out and if we wouldn't have stayed in contact, Sarah, I honestly don't know where I would be. Yeah. So we're going to talk about that today. But she really was like, I want to maintain this relationship with you. You mean a lot to me. And I really want us to stay connected. And we did. I mean, I can't remember the specifics, like if we called each other every week, but I've been like a daughter to her from the moment that I met her. And she, like, I get really emotional when I think about it. She's just kept her hand on me, even through the ugliness and, you know, me fighting through the trauma and me fighting through the pain of the trauma. She just has always had her hand on me, and not just me, but my girls too. And I really, really, you know, she's the reason why a big reason of why I'm still here and why I'm able to navigate my life the way that I have.
Yeah. Yeah. She's been like this angel.
Yeah. She has.
An absolute angel. And I think there are so many other women that likely have like that, a similar story of that. There are these central people that sometimes come from like the most unexpected places that end up playing, you know, these large roles, and like, damn, they're persistent, you know? And I'm sure that she pushed you sometimes. And I'm sure sometimes you were like, Bisa, get off my back. Like, I'm, well, you know, doing really my best.
Yeah. Like really, like she's been like a mom that I never had. Like, yeah. I don't want to take away any of Gloria's, you know, efforts and trying to raise me. And she, now I realize she did the best that she could, but I mean, Bisa has just loved me in a way that I never experienced with Gloria. And, you know, even like through my ugliness, like she's patient and she's like, I still love you and I'm still here and what she offers. And, you know, like things like taking me to go get my driving test, you know, and, you know, like when I'm devastated and when I'm falling apart, and she's like, okay, Danny, like we're going to pick ourselves up and we're going to keep going. And she's just been a model of what mother should be like. And that's something that, you know, I really was never able to access before.
Yeah. Okay. So we have to get back to the Trevor story. So we broke up with Bisa's son. And then when did you meet Trevor?
Yes. Sorry. Yeah. Yep. So we broke up, and her son and I broke up, and I was a statistician for the boys basketball team. Trevor was all-star. He was like, you know, being scouted for the NBA, like really amazing player. And of course I know nothing about what any of that means. But I knew how to take stats, and I was with a couple of my girlfriends, and Trevor was arrogant. Like he was, and I was attention seeking. So I was like everything that he hated, and he was everything that I hated. And then one day after practice, I was like going to McDonald's back when I used to eat McDonald's, and I asked him what he wanted, and he ordered the exact same thing that I ordered. Quarter pounder with cheese with no mayonnaise and extra barbecue sauce and an orange high C. And I like went, it's like, oh my gosh, that's exactly what I order. And so we started talking, and he was like, I hate mayonnaise. And I was like, I hate mayonnaise too. Oh my gosh. And he was like, yeah, I also don't eat chocolate. And I was like, me neither. And you know, being 17 years old, that was like phenomenal.
These were like massive and connections. You're like, we're meant to be.
Yeah.
Like, we're totally.
Yeah. At 17. And like, I don't know what happened, and him and I talk about this all the time, but like a veil lifted between us because we really hated each other. Like he would, like after games, like, you know, he'd look at the stats and he would be like, I had 36 rebounds. And I was like, no, dude, you had like four. And he would like yell at me and I'd be like yelling back and he'd be like, you're messing up my stats. And it was just him and I, like, we were just butt heads. And so in this moment of like us not eating mayonnaise and chocolate, a veil lifted and I don't know, an attraction formed. And I was his first love. It was the first time that he had really, and really what he loved and he still does. And we talk about this often, was my vulnerability. You know, I'm very kind of sensitive and emotional and I have hearts in my eyes and I'm a, you know, I'm a romantic and I'm a softie. And he had never really experienced that before. And so we, you know, back then my mom was really strict, so I really couldn't go out and he was so focused on basketball. So our first date ended up being our senior prom, even though we had been talking and stuff, we had never really gone out on a date. And that was our first date. Really. And I think the first picture that we had together was in our like prom.
Oh, and I've seen that picture and it is amazing.
Yeah, he was like, I'm not going to smile. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to smile either. And it looks like we are miserable. But like,
yeah, but that was like the style, Danielle. When we were in high school, we thought we were all so hard, you know? And so we're, you know, there's like, that was like the look, right? Yeah. I mean, like you guys encapsulated, you know, like almost so many of my friends from high school. I was like, that's how, you know, we were in high school in the 90s.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny, 20 something years later, we recreated it on our wedding day. And I haven't like put it up in our house, but I just, I think it's brilliant. Like it's so funny. It's just, it's so funny.
Okay. But then people need to understand, like, so Trevor, you know, you're his first love. You guys are all like, you know, cupcaked up together in high school, but then you go off to college and you guys don't stay together.
Nope. So again, I very sheltered, in and out of foster homes, like really, really rough. And there's a whole nother episode for a podcast when, you know, when I, to talk about all that stuff. I go off to college really kicking and screaming because I'm like, I don't know what this is. I don't know about college. I don't know anything. And Bisa literally like packed me up, dropped me off in Long Beach and was like, be great. And I'm not there 2 or 3 months, meet a boy, get pregnant within 3 months. I hate to say, but it's such a vital part of my story that I have to share it. And this obviously devastated Trevor. You know, we were kind of, we couldn't see each other and, you know, it was kind of, we didn't know where we, you know, were with each other. I got pregnant and, it was devastating. I can't even tell you how devastating it was. But I called him casually and was like, hey, by the way, I'm pregnant. And now I know the devastation, but then it was kind of like, I don't know. I was, you know, 19 at the time and I couldn't even process like what that meant for us or him. And yeah, so I ended up pregnant my very first semester in college. I mean, the semester it just started, living in the dorms. And yeah, I ended up pregnant, knew immediately I wasn't going to, you know, have an abortion or, you know, that my only option was to have the baby. But I remember my first thought was like, oh my gosh, like Gloria had me at 19.
Yeah. And I remember we talked about this. You're like, I was hell bent that I was not going to make the same kind of mistakes that my mom did. And here I am at 19 years old, pregnant. Yep. And also, you know, with a guy who was not the greatest, you know? But it's so, this is what people need to understand. Like that's just the beginning of what else transpired. So, you know, you had your daughter, Lexi, and is she 21 right now?
22.
Oh my gosh. 22. I know. And people can't see this. I'm like, she's beautiful. I've seen so many pictures where she's, you know, just a stunning young woman. But in the midst of this, your mother is also, her health is declining very, very rapidly. Yeah. And as a result of just a lot of years of illness and substance abuse, et cetera, and her body's really failing her. And so how old was Lexi born when she passed or was Lexi not, like, what was the timeline on that?
Yeah. Just to back up a little bit, I find out I'm pregnant. I know I'm going to keep the baby. I just met, you know, her dad. You know, we had been kind of hanging out and having fun for 3 months. The first time we were together, I got pregnant. So I didn't know what I was getting into. And again, being, you know, very, you know, I don't know, cupcakey and like walking on clouds, I'm going to have a baby and
it's going to be fine.
Yeah. Like, and I went to Gloria and she was just like, you're going to end up just like me. And I think it was in that moment that I was like, no, I'm not. Like, I've got to do something different. And I wasn't a wild child. I wasn't like out there. I had, you know, I just left home for the first time, lost my mind for a minute, but realized in that moment that she said that if I don't like come up with a plan, like I can't just go through life and let things, you know, let the chips fall as they may. Like, I have to put effort into what my life is going to look like. I am going to end up like her. You know, I lived in the dorms, ended up pregnant towards the end of, I don't know, that first year. Time kind of gets lost. You know, this is 20 something years ago. At some point, her dad was like, let's move in together. We're going to have this baby. Mm-hmm. And throughout the course of my pregnancy, it had just gotten exceptionally worse. It just, you know, there was a lot of psychological abuse. There was a lot of
meaning the relationship with C's biological.
Yeah. And, so there was a lot of like psychological abuse. He came from, a family that was pretty challenged. You know, they had their own issues that they were dealing with. And it was progressively getting worse. So I had a really rough child, pregnancy, dealing with just the abuse that was happening. I was essentially, you know, homeless. You know, I was living in the dorms, and so we moved in together. And at that point, his mom had to get an apartment for us because we were too young to have an apartment in our names. And I'd gotten a job. His aunt had gotten me a job out in Torrance, my first like official job. I was really excited. It was above minimum wage. It was a legit job. I was going to do that all day, go to school all night with a brand new baby. And I came home, the baby was like 6 weeks old. I came home and her dad accused me of something. And I got a lot of attention. I got a lot of attention back then from other men. And he saw that, and this always made him jealous. And I came home and there were a lot of men at the job. And I guess the aunt was reporting that I was getting this attention, and he did not like that. And I came home and he just went ballistic and kind of started accusing me of things. And I was just like, that's it. I cannot deal with this. And so I suggested, why don't I stay in the apartment? I don't want to go back home to Victorville. And you know, you can move back in with your parents. And he just was like, no. He called his mom and dad came over and basically kicked me out. Of course I wasn't going to leave my baby. So I went to the gas station across the street just to kind of think. That ended up being 3 weeks of me living in my car, going to work, going to school with a six-week-old baby, until a friend had reached out to me, and I told her what was going on. And she was like, nope, you're coming to stay with me. So, that was kind of Lexi's, I guess, introduction to the world.
And then when did your mom pass?
Mom passed shortly after that. So I don't remember the time frame. Again, time is lost, but that year, she wasn't even a year old yet. So then, during that time, while I was living with my friend Winter, and her mom, Debbie, my mom passed away, and that was pretty devastating. What I had a hard time dealing with for years after she died was my mom was sick and she was in and out of the hospital because she was an addict her whole life. I don't know if I mentioned that. So she struggled with addiction. She used to be addicted to heroin, and then she kicked that sometime, maybe when she was in jail. And then she really struggled with alcohol. And I remember in my childhood, she would be in and out of, you know, so I assume she used when we were younger, but always alcohol. She always struggled with alcohol, and she was kind of on and off and in and out. And so she had a stroke. Well, actually she came down one weekend and I had a full weekend. I was very busy with everything and had a lot going on. And she came down unannounced with my little sister, who had just had a baby. She was 17 at the the time. Mm-hmm. And I was furious. I was a brat and I just kind of went ballistic and was like, you guys can't invade my life. And I was a brat. And I remember looking at Gloria and seeing that she was sick, knowing that she had just gotten out of the hospital. And I remember, like, after she left, after I like kicked her out of my house and my little sister and her new, you know, baby, I was kicked her out and looked at my mom and remember thinking, like, I've got to call her and apologize. Like, I was a jerk, you know? And I remember before she left, she was like, let's watch a movie. Like, why don't you come home and we'll watch Somewhere in Time. That was her favorite movie. And I was mm-hmm. like, yeah, whatever. And so this whole weekend, so that was on like a Saturday. So mm-hmm. all day Sunday, I was like, I've got to call her and apologize. Like, that just wasn't cool. Like, I'll come down next weekend. We'll watch a movie. And Sarah, Monday, I was in school all day. I got home at like 10:30 mm-hmm. and had bunch of missed phone calls that she had had a stroke that day, that she mm-hmm. had been rushed to the hospital, and that I needed to make the decision to take her off life support.
Yeah.
And and that's how she died.
So she was not even 40 years old.
She was like 42.
Or 42. Okay. She was so 42, yeah. So like, I mean, our age essentially.
Our age.
And but her body was just like had been ravaged so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like your mom passes, this is traumatic, but you also have this younger brother who, because your sister could take care of herself at that time and she also had a baby, but your brother was he 10?
11.
Yeah. 11. Yeah. So you're like, okay, I guess I'm going to have to take care of him too. So now you find yourself with a 1-year-old, mm-hmm. you're grieving, you know, your mother's death, and now you are the guardian of your 10-year-old brother.
Yeah.
And you're like, I guess I'm raising 2 kids.
Yeah. Well, my whole life, Gloria had kind of given me this responsibility of my little sister and brother. I remember having to go to my sister's classroom, pick her up, like 6, 7 years old. She was like 6 or 7. I was like, you know, 8 or 9, you know, walk her home from school and then take my little newborn brother from the neighbors and like watch them at home by ourselves. Like mm-hmm. we were latchkey kids. So I always had this responsibility over them. At that point, my little sister, you know, had been in a relationship and had a baby, even though it wasn't healthy at the time, but that's where her life was. And here's my brother. And my mom had always said, if I die, cremate me. And I want you to take, you know, Christopher. And so that's the only map I had, Sarah, was, mm-hmm. okay, I'm going to cremate her. Or she was like, if I'm ever on life support, take me off, cremate me and take your brother. And so that was what I had. I got to the hospital. The doctor asked me what to do with her. I said, well, her wishes are to take her off life support. Sarah, I hadn't even thought, I hadn't even processed it. I hadn't. Yeah. Looking back now, I don't know if I would have done something different. I mean, she was completely brain dead. She had a stroke. She was in a vegetative state. She had lost, you know, all functionality.
Yeah.
But it was so kind of robotic. And I mean, can you imagine at like 19, 20 years old, like having to,
no,
I had no like map. It was just, this is what Gloria said she wanted. So let's take her off life support. We were in there. Like, I was holding her hand as like literally the breath left her body. My brother was there and he was kind of like numb and unresponsive. And it was like, all right, like we're going to get her cremated. And I have her ashes, you know, upstairs. We have a family room and she's up there, you know, in her family room. And you're coming to live with me. And mm-hmm. that was it, Sarah. Like it was just, that's what Gloria said. And so that's the only map I have to navigate this.
Yeah. But what I think is the, you know, part of the most powerful piece of your story is despite all of these things, you still finished school. It took you, was it 7 years to finish undergrad? 7 years to finish undergrad, because I mean, you're a single working mother of 2 kids. So you have to like, obviously, you know, provide financially for your family, go to school. And then you went to graduate school. And throughout all of this, I want to get back to Trevor because, you know, cause you guys have been, you guys had, you know, this kind of like dance with each other, right? Like
dancing or boxing, however.
Right. You know, because, but that's like you guys, right? You're just like, you're almost, it's like these like opposites that make so much sense together. And so it's like, you're trying to figure out, both coming from backgrounds where we're like, gosh, we didn't have necessarily the best examples of what it means to do this right. But I think we want to, and just kind of like, you know, trying and failing. You said at one point, like you guys lived together for a while and then that would like went bad. Because like neither of you just had those skill sets to kind of figure out like, how do we do this? And I think that there's so many people out there. Like I always think it's, you know, like there's no like handbook that we can reference. Like if you don't have examples of like what it is to be in healthy relationship, what it is to be in healthy partnership, do we think that just like vicariously, we're just going to like spontaneously figure it out? Right. And what I have so much respect for both you and Trevor, and I think especially for Trevor, as a Black male, is like, he did like the therapeutic work. You know, he was just like, I need to figure this out for myself, you know?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So another part of this story was that his mom died a year before, on the same day before my mom died. And so we had lost contact, obviously, after I had Alexia. And I reached out, you know, and kind of, it took a bit of time for me to get a hold of him. And obviously he was still very angry and he was mourning, but I just kind of kept checking in on him over the year. And exactly a year later on the same day, Gloria died. And he was like, like, we need to figure this out. Yeah. I'm going to help you figure this out. And, you know, here I am trying to go to school, which he doesn't really, he's not very, the only reason why he got a degree was because he had a full ride scholarship because of basketball. Mm-hmm. He stopped playing basketball after his mom died, and he finished eventually, but he's not like big on education. He's, you know, self-made. And so he kept kind of saying, you need to stop going to school. Like, you need to go out and get a job. You have two children. Like, he's very practical. Like, you don't need to get in debt, and you know, like, you need to kind of go out and hustle, and which I can appreciate and respect. But for me, it was like, if I don't like get an education, how are my children, how am I going to break these generational curses that I've been a part of for all these, you know, years? And so, it took me 7 years, but he was supportive during that time. He was establishing his own business. He's an entrepreneur. And, and we were kind of in and out, kind of doing this dance, doing this boxing in this boxing ring for years and years and years. It was ugly. And a big root of the problem, which I didn't realize until a few years ago, was Alexia. He just could not come to terms with, he had kind of had this thought about our life. And even though we had never talked about it, I mean, we were only 17, he had this thought about our life. And then I have a baby, and then he has to navigate that. He has to come in and be this stepfather, and and it was very, very challenging for him. And then when I wanted to go on to my master's, he was like, I don't think you should do that. I think, you know, you should just focus on your job. But my job was requiring, you know, like, a behavior analyst. So at this point, I was a supervisor in school districts, and they were like, if you want to keep your job, you have to have a master's degree to provide supervision. So I just kept going. He really had to take a lot over the course of 20 years. And really, I was like, I won't leave Long Beach because I share custody with her dad. And even though this is not a healthy relationship, like, I respect that Alexia has a father, and I don't want to interfere in that relationship. And he looked at that as me accommodating this man. Really, he didn't have a lot of respect for, and it was a challenging relationship for me to navigate as Alexia's mom. It was challenging for Alexia to navigate. And from Trevor's perspective, he was like, why are you fighting so hard to stay here? I want to move to Vegas. I want to get out of Long Beach. And I was just like, not until she's 18. So it was a really, really challenging position for him to be in. And that was a big part of our issue for really 20 years. And it wasn't until, and even we had tried therapy when, you know, because we'd break up and we'd go to therapy to deal with the breakup just so that we wouldn't get pulled back into the relationship. And then finally, we were both like at a place where we'd moved in together in Long Beach. He was like, he wasn't happy. I wasn't happy. I was just like, I don't want to spend another 10 years of this chaos, this insanity. So I asked him to move out. He did. Then I was angry at him for moving out, for not like fighting. But in that time, his dad had got a cancer diagnosis, so he wasn't going to make it. And his dad really was like, if you're going to, like, I know you love her. If you're going to figure this out, like if you're going to be with her, then you need to get it together. And during that time, I had started going to intensive therapy because I had had a breakdown of sorts. I was the clinical director of a ABA agency. I couldn't pass the exam. I was unhappy. My daughter was struggling with her relationship with her father. And I had a complete breakdown and started doing intensive therapy. And both of us were kind of in these healing spaces. And at the end of that year, Trevor had kind of just came back to me and said, look, I want to do this, but this is how we're going to do it. And he really laid out and redefined what our relationship was going to be like and what our life was going to be like, what Alexia's life was going to be like until she graduated from high school. And he laid it out. And that's kind of the map that we created together that said, all this is going away. This is our future. And that really took a good 7-8 months for us to figure that out and navigate.
So you guys got married. Was it how many years after you initially met?
So we met in 1994. And math is not my ministry. So
it's okay.
And we got married in February 1st on Super Bowl Sunday, which is probably a whole other podcast story on Super Bowl Sunday, 2015.
So 21 years.
21 years.
21 years. And then my favorite part, which is Skylar Rose.
Yes.
So Skylar Rose is your daughter with Trevor. If like she, this kid is just like, she's so incredible. And like, what did you say? She's the best of both of you.
Yeah. She's the best part of me and Trev. And it was funny. Bisa said something, and this is really like encapsulates like who Skylar is. Bisa said that Skylar was up in heaven with God. And God kept saying, it's not time yet, telling Skylar she was a star. It's not time yet. It's not time yet. Your parents have to figure it out. Your parents have to get it together. As soon as they get it together, then I can send you down. But you can't go down until they're ready.
Yeah. They ain't ready for you yet.
And so, so I didn't want babies when we got engaged. And Trevor just couldn't fathom this. He was like, I've known you since you were, 16, 17 years old. And you've always wanted babies. You're a good mom. Like, this is what you do. You've been taking care of babies your whole life. And at that
point, like, but that's exactly it. Cause I've been doing it my whole life. I'm tired.
That's it. And really a part of what my breakdown was in 2014 was like, I had come to this realization. I had been giving, pouring my entire life. Like, I started ABA when I was pregnant with Alexia, Sarah, like giving. And a part of that was my healing, like being able to take care of babies, like, kind of gave, was a need that was fixed inside me. And he couldn't understand it. He was like, I've known you your whole life. Like, and it's me, and I've always wanted his babies. And that's what I've been fighting for, for 21 years. But I also knew that like, I couldn't marry Trevor Beal and not like try. And so I was like, we can try it one time. Let's see how it goes. You know, I'm older. I don't even know if I can get pregnant. It's been, you know, at that point, 17 years. And Sarah, the first time we, decided we were going to have a baby, I got pregnant and I was terrified and he was excited. And he just kept saying, my champion's coming, my champion's coming. And she is, she's a champion. She is absolutely perfect. And I thank God every day that, that he gave her to us, because really, like, I just, like Bisa said, like, she was up there waiting with him.
And Bisa's her godmother.
Bisa's both of my girls' godmother.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. For both Lexi and So, and this is, we should have, next time I'll have to bring Bisa on the show. Cause I feel like she is someone that like, I need
it's
to know.
A great story. Yeah. She's awesome.
Yeah. And so, it's like you finally were able to have this, you know, the relationship that you and Trevor always wanted to have. You know, he was able to have like a healing relationship and a super positive relationship with Lexi. You have Skylar Rose, you know, became a business owner. And now what I'm interested in, and I want people to understand, is like, what does the future hold? What does the future hold for you?
I don't know. That's such a hard question, because a part of my struggle is not knowing how to, not having a voice, not knowing mm-hmm. how to advocate for myself and to get the things that I want. So I think I mentioned when I reached out to you, I've been quietly like in the trenches with my staff mm-hmm. and with my children. And, you know, you talk to any parent that I've worked with or any staff member, and they're going to tell you like Danielle is like in the trenches with us. Mm-hmm. So my leadership style is, you know, I consider myself a servant leader mm-hmm. and it's been quiet. It's kind of been like, we're in this together. And I've never really looked above kind of that trench hole, you know, mm-hmm. and for the first time, my husband is like, Danielle, you have a gift. Like I've mm-hmm. been watching you for 20 years. You know, I do presentations and I do trainings, and he's been helping me kind of, you know, with that process. And he's like, you have this gift. You need to start navigating that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm trying to figure out. I'm trying to figure out how to share my story and my voice. I recently just finished, a chapter in an anthology where I'm starting to talk about my story, because mm-hmm. I understand that it's valuable to people, especially young Black women mm-hmm. who have to overcome insurmountable odds. You know, I'm doing work in my internship. I'm finishing up my doctorate degree.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you repeat that? So not only did you do the bachelor's, your master's, the BCBA, but now you're going to be Dr. Danielle too. And I'm going to call you. I'm going to call you Dr.
Well,
Danielle.
I will demand that you call me that. And I tried to demand that Trevor call me that. He said, no, mm-hmm. no, you're still in charge of cleaning our toilets. So
he's like, let me keep you grounded.
Let me keep you humble. Yes. Yes. But yeah, so a part of my story and what's next is really moving outside of the ABA world, which mm-hmm. I will always be a part of, because that's really, it found me when I was just a baby, when I was having my own first baby, 22 years now, but really just helping other women find their voices, mm-hmm. encouraging them along their journey that you can really do whatever you want. If I can do mm-hmm. what I've done, measly Danielle Sherrill, you know, who was born in, you know, Pomona Hospital, then so can you. And I really just want to be a beacon. I want to be an encouraging light. And I hope that that I can just find my voice to be able to share my story so that it can encourage and support and uplift other women.
I mean, if you really think about it, what you're doing is you're becoming BISA.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but really, mm-hmm. she has established, you know, Sarah, I always say, I don't have roots, right? Mm-hmm. Like I don't have family. I don't have parents. I haven't had parents, you know, more of my life than I did when she was born, when she was alive. Yeah. And so I don't have roots, but I have really strong like branches, like mm-hmm. And Trevor, and I have mm-hmm. my best friend and, you know, who's been in my life and really like Black woman, like Winter, mm-hmm. my friend from college and her mom. And I have all of these strong, like roots and the friendships that I have, and everyone in my life have really been with me since I was young, you know, mm-hmm. and they've helped to grow me and encourage me. And, you know, you think someone who doesn't have roots can't really, they don't have a foundation, but somehow they've been able to kind of ground me. Those branches ground me and they help keep me. And I just, I want to, these gifts that BISA has given me, really, I don't know what I do without her. And I want to be that for other people.
Well, this is a good place to end. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Reveal. I hope that you were able to learn something, that you were able to grow a little bit as a person as a result of listening to this episode. And I hope that you follow this podcast. We're on like every podcast platform. So it's Google, it's Spotify, it's Anchor. And this is just the beginning of a lot more really awesome stories about incredible women that are doing amazing things. So have a great day. Follow us on all of the platforms. You can follow us also on Instagram at reveal.comm and also on Facebook, which means I'm going to have to get a Facebook account, but I'll figure that out eventually. Have a great day, guys.